How long do you normally share for?
Talk as long as you want, 20 minutes, something
Okay.
like that.
Yeah, I remember I do get a bit nervous when I'm given a chair, not as nervous as I used to. When I did my very first chair, I was so nervous that I was talking to an older member and he said to me, are you planning to tell the truth? And I said, yes. He said, well, what have you got to be nervous about? And I found that advice really, really helpful. No speculation, just experience, just to tell my story as truthfully as I can. And it does change because sometimes I realize after some time that something that I always believed to be true wasn't actually true, And it's been an interesting journey. So I'm going to tell you the story of two periods of sobriety. I first went to my very first meeting in 1974. Some people find that hard to believe. I'm actually 70 in 5 days' time, but you see this sort of fairly young-looking guy, and they think, how can he possibly have? Obviously, two. Anyway, this is the truth. I went to this meeting 1974, and at the time, I'd done one of those government training courses. I wanted to sort of. I've been a bit of a hippie and worked in holiday camps and hotels and all that. Got married very young and had two children, and I was trying to make a new start of it. I wanted to be a decent husband and father and that. So I'd been along to the job centre and I wanted to sign up to train as either a social worker or something similar. So I came out having signed up to be a plumber or a plasterer. Don't ask me how. I think I got to the P's the second time around and just clicked the two of them, So I ended up training as a plumber and moving down to Cornwall, thinking I was going to start this lovely new life down there in the country. And they had this scheme down there, a new town housing scheme. And if you had a skill, they would give you somewhere to live. But I hadn't realised that you were supposed to let them get you the job. I got my own job, so I was disqualified from the scheme. And my wife and I, with our two children, who quite enjoyed our stay in Cornwall, apart from the fact that I was still an alcoholic, I mean, I arrived there thinking that I was going to have a leather armchair by the open fire in the Smuggler's Arms, and I'd have a Labrador, and someone would say, "Who's that, respectable-looking gentleman in the chair over there?" And she'd be bringing me my brandy in a warm glass, and she'd say, "Oh, that's so and so," The truth is, I arrived there and I was making faces in front of the dartboard, absolutely bored out of my brains and as pissed as a fart within a matter of days, I'd taken my alcoholism with me. And we came back to England and I went to live with my parents, who were both chronic alcoholics. My wife went to live with hers, who lived in a very posh part of London, Wimbledon. And she sent me a letter. And the letter had an article from Reader's Digest outlining four types of drinkers. There was the teetotaler, social drinker, dependent drinker, and then alcoholic. And I knew I was an alcoholic, and I phoned AA, and they told me where a meeting was in the centre of London. And I remember putting on a suit. I think I'd won some money on the horses, and I'd bought a suit. And arrived at the meeting, thinking like, let's get this sorted out, And there was people drinking tea out of plastic cups and, poor bastards. For all my disasters, I was still as arrogant as anything, I mean, I remember hearing once somebody say that they could think they were a genius and feel like a piece of shit simultaneously, and that described where I was perfectly, because that's how it was for me. I still had this sort of arrogance. I read 5 pages of Philosophy Made Simple, and I thought I should be writing my own book. You know what I mean? Anyway, so I'm sitting at this meeting, and I did identify with some of the things. Going to the pub after work and thinking I'll just have a drink, and then I'll have two, and then I'll leave at six, and then I'll leave at seven, and now fuck it, I'll just stay. And ringing the wife with some ludicrous excuse, depriving my family of money and neglect and all the rest of it, and I reached a point where I absolutely hated myself. But anyway, I left that meeting. There was a group of people who were quite evangelical, and they sort of dragged me on to another meeting at the end of that one. And they were sort of lovely people. I mean, they got me onto this other meeting. They gave me a big book, and I didn't even know that it had an inscription on the inside page. I never opened it, And I couldn't wait to get away from them. I thought I'd been captured by the Salvation Army or something, So anyway, I got a job as a porter on a slum estate in the East End. My job was cleaning out the dustbin chutes, sweeping the grounds and running the bathhouse twice a week because there were no baths in the flats. And, you know, it was a place to live with my family, you know. So, you know, decorated it, you know, thought it was great, you know. And a few months later, I was visiting the psychiatrist and I asked him if I was schizophrenic. And I really believed there was something seriously mentally wrong with me. I didn't think I was just an alcoholic. And he assured me that I was not a schizophrenic. You know, he said, who'd give you that idea? That's not the case. And they put me on Antabuse. You know, I don't know if any of you have taken it, but if you drink on Antabuse, you flare up like a beacon and you can't breathe properly, you know. And they tried me on Valium. And I took one and I refused to take it. I said, no point coming off alcohol if I'm going to go on to drugs. So I stopped that. So anyway, and it didn't occur to me to stop going to the pub. Did not cross my mind, you know. So I was going to the pub and drinking soft drinks, and people there were really behind me. My parents were both alcoholics. So I've said they were actually banned from the pub, which is probably why I chose it. And the guys there were very supportive. And I shifted from this, you know, soft drinks to, you know, that 2%. You know, shandy. I thought I'd get away with that. And of course I flared up like a beacon. I couldn't breathe properly because I was drinking it by the gallon. You know, I drank the entire stock of the bar in no time at all. And so naturally I stopped taking the Antabuse. I was still convinced that I was never going to drink again. I was swearing blind that, you know. And then when they ran out of the bottle shandy, I said, oh, just a little bit of beer and a lot of lemonade. It's exactly the same, you know. And then I said, fuck the lemonade, you know. And the other guys all, you know, unanimously shouted out, don't do it, Jim, because they knew what was going to happen. A couple of days later, I was literally kneeling on the floor in front of these guys, begging them to lend me the money to get as drunk as I needed to get. Because I never had any money. I was always poncing around and, you know, all the rest of it. So anyway, I pretended to take the Antabuse again when my wife begged me to take it. And deliberately went out and got rat-arsed in the morning. She was still pleading with me, you know, and I just told her to fuck off and take the children and go somewhere else because I felt like I had nothing to give her. And I tried to drink myself to death for a few days. You know, I just drank everything I could. Like, you know, I sold everything. I sold a leather jacket, you know, guitar, you know, the lot. I even tried to sell my flat, which I didn't even own, you know. Bloke moved in with me, he was another alcoholic, give me £5 rent, I'm like, you know, drank that. And he said to me, you know, well, we could set up this business. And I said to him, listen, if we had a business and we had £30,000, we'd still be in this same fucking pub, drinking this same shit, and it would make no difference to our lives whatsoever, you know. And I remember wandering around in this pub in the East End, saying to people, I don't understand, life doesn't make any sense to me. And eventually someone said to me, well, why don't you just fuck off and top yourself? And I remember going into the toilet and then coming out again, and I'd managed to smash the back of my head. And I've got this vague recollection of doing it on purpose, that I'd tried to fall against a sink, ended up on the floor, and then I'd leaned forward and thrown my head back and came out, and the woman behind the counter fainted with blood everywhere. Ended up in the London hospital in Whitechapel. And you know, I left that hospital having chatted to this psychiatrist. You know, they recognised I was in a bad way, like, you know, I was covered in blood and all the rest of it. And I had to go past the meeting that I'd been to 11 months earlier. And it happened to be on at the time when I was passing. So I was heading down to London Bridge. I was going to jump. And I passed this meeting. I went in there to give myself this one last chance. And it actually moved around the corner. So I still had to make that bit of effort. And I went into this meeting and I got up to leave because I didn't think they had anything to offer. And the bloke grabbed my coat, called me back. And, you know, they just rallied. They just responded to me. You know, in the city of London, they're all business people in suits. And I was quite literally covered in blood. It was all over my hair, all over my clothes, you know, dirt and blood. And these guys dragged me onto a cafe afterwards. And they were great. They surrounded me in the cafe to make sure I couldn't get out and persuaded me to stay alive at that time. And a bloke called John W., who was, one of these news reporters, you'd hear his voice from the on the TV, but you didn't see his face, you know. And he'd actually cut his throat once in a hotel, you know, and it'd been through the same as me, really. You know, and he said to me, look, you know, the door swings both ways. Here's my phone number. If you want help, give me a ring. And if you want to go back out, go back out, you know. And he kept me sober. I rang him every day, and he'd say to me, what are you doing for your sobriety today? And he never told me what to do. And he used to lead me to the right, to the conclusion that I needed to go to meetings, you know. I said to him once after a little while, well, I was thinking of going to the pitches. I mean, I've been going to meetings every day. And he said to me, oh, so John Wayne's keeping you sober these days, is he? So I went to a meeting, you know, and I'd forgotten that I'd applied to go to college. I left school at 15, you know. And I got this invitation to go in, and, you know, I got into this college, did these very basic exams that you take when you're 16, you know, and I was 25, coming up for 25. I was 24 at the time. And they let me onto this course. And when I told the people at the meeting, they said to me, just think of the difference you could make to people like you if you succeed. And it was like rocket fuel to me. I really wanted to become someone worth being, because I'd been a loser all my life, you know. So to become someone who could help other people was a huge, huge thing to me, you know. So I went in and I started these five O-levels. And I was working, you know, in the evenings, because my wife came back with the kids, working in the evenings, doing the course during the day. And I was literally falling off the chair in the class. And they managed to get me a discretionary grant to study, you know, as a family man with two kids. You know, it was a Labour local council, and they did that sort of thing in those days. Thatcher abolished all that, of course. But anyway, they helped me out. They gave me a grant enough to support myself and my family. And I got these five O-levels, and I went along to the meeting to tell them this great success. Like, I got these five O-levels. And I sobbed like a child, because even, blimey, it's come back up. Because even though in my head I thought I was a genius, in my heart I never felt it. So passing those exams was a huge, huge psychological barrier. And I started my own A-levels, became student union chairperson, all that sort of thing. And a big turning point occurred when my mother, who I said was chronic alcoholic, I got her to go to a meeting. I took her to a meeting. Also took her to get assessed for, you know, to go into rehab. And she was told that she lived in the wrong catchment area, so they wouldn't accommodate her. And unfortunately, she went into a derelict building with other alcoholics and got battered. And eventually, after 2.5 weeks, she died of her injuries, murdered by persons unknown, you know. And it hit me hugely, you know. And initially, because I was the strongest remaining member of the family, I've got two sisters, I looked after my dad. I was afraid that he might commit suicide or something. So, I was keeping the sort of whatever up, you know. And I was all over the place, really. You know, I'm surprised I didn't have a breakdown, to be honest. And it broke that whole spell of, I mean, if people said things like, you know, in God's universe, everything happens for a reason, it just sounded not just like nonsense. It sounded insulting, you know. So I couldn't sort of go along with that. And it never occurred to me to drink, but about 5 years later, I did. And it took me quite a long time to stop again. But what had happened was I got my first job after university and getting a teaching qualification. I studied for 7 years as a full-time student. And when I got the job, the interview involved going to a pub as part of the interview day. And I did the same mistake. I had bottle shandies and, you know, and I was away with the fairies, you know. And it took me a long time. I was in and out for years. And eventually I came back in 1990, and I've been sober ever since then, you know, so 31 years. And, one of the things that I needed to do, I felt like I needed something that went a little bit deeper than the rational mind. So I started, I dedicated myself to meditation. I went and lived in a retreat center for about, 7 weeks, and then another two, so 9 weeks. And I arrived there, I gave up cigarettes when I arrived. And I remember going through withdrawal symptoms with a pickaxe, you know, sort of. And I'm with these guys, you know, sort of, they're all really quiet guys. It wasn't complete silence, but they didn't chat, which really suited me. I didn't need anyone asking me questions. And I just I spent quite a lot of time weeping. You know, often on my own, I went for walks in the woods around in the retreat centre and just wept, you know, and allowed myself to remember things that I was desperately trying to forget. I did not want to be that bloke whose mother was murdered. I didn't want to be that, you know what I mean? And I remember allowing myself to just remember what she looked like in the hospital bed, because it was unrecognisable. It was unbelievable, you know, and to just be with that, you know, not to be pushing it away, not to be clinging to it, not no stewardship, but at the same time sitting with it and recognising it. And it was very, very helpful to me. So by the time I came out of there, you know, I was sort of, I had a really good meditation practice, which I kept up. And I've remained committed to that. I don't formally meditate anymore at all. I just sit. I don't do any technique or anything like that. And it seems to suit me. I did form a meditation for over 20 years and taught it. And I've never at any time tried to convert anyone to anything that I believe. But, you know, it helped me. And that's the truth of it, you know. So, you know, I don't know how long I've been going. I don't want to stay too long on the thing. But, you know, the things that have helped me enormously, you know, I love being around people who celebrate sobriety, you know. I'm amazed at what I've experienced in AA as a result of being sober. You know, in my second time around, when I finally stopped drinking, I couldn't, I remember having, I mentioned the other night when I was talking, you know, I was invited to have four tins of lager and watch a video. By the time I was into the, we had two each. By the time I was into the halfway through the first one, I'd already started working out where to get the money because I didn't have any money. And then I decided that I'd go down to Biddy's bar and I'd give her my passport and she'd lend me 30 quid. So I drank the second tin, never mind the fucking video, on the way down to the bar, and Biddy came across with his 30 quid and I was away with the fairies, you know. And that was my last drink. You know, in the morning, they kicked me out of the house. And in the morning, they said to me, you can stay another week if you promise not to drink. And I looked on my hand on heart and I could not say with any certainty that I wasn't going to drink. And I knew that I was out of control and that I needed help, you know. And when I got back into A that day, I met up with a bloke that I'd known when I first got sober 46 years ago, you know, this year sort of. And he, you know, been sober for about 45 then. He'd slipped after about a year, never since. And he helped me out. He gave me a place to stay. And, you know, it was very encouraging. So the help that I've had in AA has been unbelievable, you know. And I don't mind what anyone believes as long as they don't shove it down my throat. But I do think that if people build their sobriety on shaky foundations, they're in trouble. You know, so I tend to want to keep my feet firmly on the ground, you know. So anyway, I'll finish with that. And thank you so much for having me. I was, for a while, actually, an ordained Buddhist, believe it or not. You know, so I gave that up, resigned and all that. I had a special name and everything. But I've moved beyond that. Anyway, so thank you very much for your time.